Welcome to The Property Wizard, brought to you by Creative Insight, helping you connect, and Gentry Learning, real estate professionals and educators. If you are brand new to the real estate investment world or have limited experience, you've come to the right place. Fred Crouch has over 35 years of real estate investing experience. He's seen it all, and he's ready to share it with you. This podcast takes an inside look at investing in real estate, what to look for, and most of all, how to move forward. Please welcome the property wizard, Fred Crouch.
A big thank you to the team at Carl Speaks, headed up by no other than Mr. Podcast himself, Carl Richards. We would especially like to acknowledge and thank our producer, Dom Carrillo, and supporting this awesome duo, our Nathan Simon, who created the original sound score, and Caroline Nicolai, who every episode supplies us with new cover artwork. Thank you, everyone, for the wonderful effort. So, Bernie, let's have a quick recap about our last podcast when we discussed real estate fraud with Rob Lewis. Any thoughts?
Well, tons of thoughts. Anybody can be hacked and anybody can be duped. So you always got to be mindful, right? So ultimately, and if it's socially engineered, you're really going to be having a hard time. So be cautious. And nothing is ever that important. It has to be instantly on. It's not a Big Mac you're getting.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And this is why our guest today, Phil LaRocque, is going to be such a, like, just a great addition. Great follow-up podcast to Rob's. There were a couple takeaways, and I think it never hurts to kind of revisit them. And if you bear with me, I'd just like to go through them. These are, call them wizard's rules if you want. But these are things that I think are really important when it comes to considering any investment in real estate, or when anybody approaches you with these pie in the sky figures, and when it sounds too good to be true, it usually is, propositions. So, rule number one, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. Rule number two, do not succumb to high pressure sales tactics. I think you would both agree. You just don't want to do that. And a lot of people, unfortunately, I don't know why, I really have a lot of difficulty understanding why they're so quick to write a check because someone has just come out and said, hey, give me this money and you're going to get this outrageous return. And they don't think anything more of it. Rule number three, if you can't see it or touch it, stay away from it. Now, that rule is specific to real property. I'm talking about bricks and mortar real estate. There's all sorts of ways you can invest your money in GICs where there isn't necessarily something that you can actually attach or touch. But when we're talking about an investment in real property, whether somebody approaches you to lend money for a mortgage, or if someone is approaching you to invest money for an actual real estate acquisition, again, if you can't see it or touch it, stay away from it. Rule number four, stay away from unsolicited real estate offers. Don't turn around and be so quick to jump on board, particularly when you don't know the individual. Rule number five, read the fine print of any offering and don't be afraid to ask questions. Don't. And if you don't know what questions to ask, then turn around and ask somebody whom you trust. Maybe your lawyer, could be another real estate broker. Maybe it's just somebody that you've known for quite some time that has a strong accounting background. Maybe you can give Phil a call and he'll tell you. The last rule, know both the person making the offering and people you're going to be involved with. Anytime we put together a co-tenancy, or anytime we're considering buying a piece of property, we always have a meeting. Call it a meeting of the minds so that we can sit down and discuss what the plan is going to be moving forward. It's a great time to meet everybody. It's a great time if there's any maybe disagreements on what should or shouldn't be done. That's the time to do it. Know the people you're investing with. There's nothing wrong with that. Yes, it takes a little more time, but these rules are meant for you. not the other people. They're meant for you. They want to keep you safe. And if you follow them, listeners, I think you'll be well on your way. Either one of you gentlemen care to elaborate? Do you think maybe those are anything else you think we should add?
Well, you know what? There is one other element did come up in Rob's conversation. Two of the incidents that he had were either potential fraud or that was kind of slimy to do, were all family member related. So you might know the person. So knowing the person.
Good point.
So the other key element is it's like, okay, here's an idea. Get that advice, that team that surrounds you, goes, that gives you that second opinion that, you know, the cold hard facts are, they're not my relative. And it's either, you know, this is good, or these are the questions to ask to get clarity on.
Yeah, that's very, very true. Yeah, in his particular, in the cases or the examples that he spoke about, in many cases involved another family member. And that was actually quite surprising. But, you know, it doesn't seem to be, family doesn't really seem to matter when it comes to any type of inheritance. And I don't know about the two of you, but I've heard all sorts of horror stories about, you know, mother told me she was going to leave me this and it didn't happen. So it created a lifelong dispute moving forward. Well, we're not going to worry about the vase in the corner. We're talking about the real estate. So from there, let's move on to In the News.
From the current events desk of the Property Wizard, it's news of the week.
Listeners, once again, we've changed up the format a bit on you, and we are going to have a round table discussion, all three of us, including Phil LaRocque, who will be more formally introduced a little later during the podcast. Today, I pulled a very interesting article from the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, their finance and development magazine. It appeared in the June 2025 issue, and it was written by David Bloom, Michael Kun, and Klaus Prettner. And again, I apologize if I haven't pronounced that correct, but I think I got a pretty good chance that I have. So the article goes on to say, and this is something that we had quite a discussion before the tape started rolling. It's a topic that really is only just coming to light. And let me just read something very quickly to you about this article. The world is experiencing a dramatic demographic change from rapid population growth during the past century to depopulation in the current century. The relentless and precipitous fall in fertility is the main driver of this transition, which also involves a historically unprecedented rise in the number of people of advanced age. Now, listeners, advanced age, I think that's a matter of definition. I think in this round table, definitely Bernie and I, really, we're of a much greater advanced age than Phil is, but... You know, I don't know. I guess maybe the older it gets, the better. I'm not going to debate that with you one way or the other. So there's a lot of things that this touches on. Our interest, of course, is what's going to happen? What's going to happen to all this real estate that we're building right now at a furious pace? To be more specific, the IMF says that the population, the current population, will probably peak somewhere around 10.2 billion souls. But that's going to start to decrease. And in many developing countries right now, you're seeing a major decrease in the number of, or the, not just their population, but their population growth. So you're seeing a major decrease in the number of children that are coming into the world. China's, I don't know how to phrase this, infamous one child rule has been lifted. And it's been lifted because they're suffering from a major depopulation crisis. So it's really, really shifted. So from that standpoint, I want to throw it out to Bernie, Phil, for your takeaways. What did you think about the article? How do you see things developing? What does it mean for the world of real estate and real estate investing, because this really throws a lot of things into the mix. Bernie, who's my de facto research department, sent me an article just before showtime that stated that BC has experienced a 41,000 person drop in its population for the first time in, I believe, 156 years. Unprecedented. And you're seeing this more and more and more. So, gentlemen, tell me what your takeaways are.
Well, first off, the one-child policy, if you only favor males, that's half the equation, and you need males and females, as far as I know, to have a population.
Can you explain that to us?
Well, yeah, Fred, I can explain it for you. But, you know, if you hadn't had that basic biology, it doesn't matter what you identify as, you need these two parts to come together. I think several things are at play here. You're talking immigration, which some people get, it's a hot-button topic. You're talking about you're actually doing really well. And when you're thriving, do you need more people? Typically, if you do studies from watching animal studies where, if the community is thriving really well, they don't tend to repopulate as much because there's no point, right? And if we're talking agrarian society and, with limited health resources, you need more kids because your population doesn't normally survive it. So those are kind of underlying factors. And the one-child policy, I think, also is a part of a decision that someone made thinking they were worried about being overpopulated.
Absolutely. That was the big hot topic. Can you remember, well, it'd be more relevant for Bernie and I, when we were in, middle school, high school, was the talk. How many more persons can the world support? How many, it's just...
Apparently more.
Apparently a lot more than what it was before. Did you find that, Phil? Was that ever a topic?
It was. I'm a product of being brought up in the 80s and 90s. Definitely was a point of discussion. To me, this article really just underlines uncertainty, right? In modern day, the historical context, the population has not shrunk, especially with the record keeping that we have today. So we just don't know what's ahead of us, right? But it's also not surprising because to me, this is back to the economics of the invisible hand, right? Supply and demand. So as the population increases, prices of resources get scarce, price goes up, and then you have a reaction, right? Supply and demand kind of equalizes everything. So it'll be very interesting. The thing that I love about this article too is that it's, we're focusing on real estate today, but it's way broader than that, right? And we talked a little bit before the show started. This is every single sector of the economy, right? The big demographic changes, whether that's, you can talk about geography, location, you can talk about segments of the population by age. They all have an impact on different sectors of the economy. And so it'll be very interesting to see how that develops. But as it pertains to real estate, again, I'm going to lean on the supply demand factor, right? I think you're always going to have high demand in city centers, right? So I don't expect wild fluctuations, I would say, in pricing in big cities. But as you go outside those areas, those are probably areas that are more susceptible to change.
Yeah. What's really unique in this entire discussion topic is that, and the point that the article makes is that there's also this aging wave, which really does have an effect on, real estate. And we're starting to see changes where it's almost history in reverse. It's going back. If there's such a, I'm not, the analogy isn't quite, it's not quite clear. But what I'm saying, it used to be that older family members used to move in with their children as they aged. And I think what you're going to see in a lot of situations is you're going to see a return to that. And you're already seeing situations where new homes are being built with in-law suites, and in some cases, standalone and independent apartments. I toured a building just last week that was exactly that way. Semi-detached, newly built, beautiful three-bedroom dwelling, and in the lower level of each of these was a smaller, I say a glorified bachelor, but a one bedroom unit. And in that particular case, you can see there seems to be a bit of a a trend towards that. And it's existed for a while. This isn't anything new. And most of our listeners know that. But I think that's going to become more and more prevalent. The article makes a point. It says that the aging wave is already here. In countries experiencing population decline, the share of people 65 years of age and older will nearly double from 17.3% to 30.9% by 2050. Now, 2050 is, you think that's a long way away, but I'm going to tell you, 25 years goes by pretty fast. And apparently, Canada is tracking the same curve. It's not any different. It's the same thing is happening in Canada. So getting back to the whole housing thing, you know, the point is also made that the housing demand, and this lends more fill to what it was you were saying, the housing demand shifts, not just shrinks. So because you have fewer children and smaller populations means less need for spending on housing and childcare. It doesn't get any more simple than that. If this isn't voodoo science, that's the reality. So my question to the two of you is this. How relevant are these findings and these points to an investment in real estate today? Now, we're talking a generation, quite literally. That's what we're doing between when the harsh reality of a lot of these things is going to hit us smack dab in the middle of the forehead. I understand that. But what do you think it means for today's investor? Where do you think the promise is when it comes to maintaining a strong portfolio?
So Fred, I'm gonna steal a line from you. When you have a problem, you have an opportunity. It would be, you know, if I was investing in real estate, I would look at this as an opportunity, right? If you want a well-balanced portfolio, you cannot ignore this trend.
Yeah, absolutely. Particularly when it comes to portfolios that are being created that will establish like generational wealth. That really is, if you have the foresight to envision what will be happening, I think you'll position yourself in such a way that you'll be able to take full advantage of that. And what this is generally saying is that, okay, all right, I think, and this touches on so many different things, you know, as we become more efficient, and we were talking about employee earlier before the recording started, we were talking about, you know, high tech and how people are losing or continue to lose their jobs and what the future holds. There's really a synchronicity between that happening and what's happening. Again, I think we're going to go through a period of time where it's a little bit of a quagmire, but I think long-term wise, I think you're going to see it kind of work out. Would you agree?
I think one of the things Phil brought up earlier, you know, if you have a drastic change in the employment force, technology comes in and flips something on its head, people will migrate to a new task, right? We talked about early 1900s, you know, the transition from agrarian to, you know, more mechanized. And we're running into that now. I think it's the flexibility piece. And this, even from the housing perspective, what do I have now? And how long do I plan on holding it? So if I have a house that lasts only 25 years, the 25-year forecast might not matter. I've already recovered my money. However, if you buy that house in year 24 now, or that property in year 24, your frame of mind, it's got to be, it's doing this now and it's declining. And, you know, there might be an opportunity because there's a new problem on the horizon, you know, to kind of come back to that adage. How can you repurpose it? You know, we've had that conversation about office towers, you know, that are vacant. You know, can you make it into housing? Yeah.
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. It depends, you know.
Yeah, and it depends on the sense of humor of everybody involved. So forecasting, well, it does, right? You know, is there money in this, you know, anyhow, without getting into the to the minutiae, how do you forecast something? Because here, I heard someone talking, they knew to build houses in the Kanata area. And I said, well, how did they know that? What was the tell? It's like you're playing poker, right? Except, you know, your adversary, your opponent is not, you know, holding cards. It's life. He says, we saw more hotels were starting to drop buildings into place, high-end hotels. More of them were being built in the area. That was our tell.
Good. Well, yeah, and that would hold true in some instances. Then again, I see hotels being built in places I can't to this day understand why they built them. But anyways, that's neither here or there. I think it just overall, to sum it up, I think, you know, as the population eventually decreases and as we work ourselves through this coming quagmire, I think you're going to see situations where there's going to be purpose-built neighborhoods. And we see that today, but I think even more so. I think where there'll be self-sufficient, to a point, communities. I think community hubs that are going to cater more to the elderly, maybe those that don't want to, you know, and don't have a need to be placed into a nursing or assisted living care, that type of thing. And you see that. That's nothing new, but I think you're going to see more and more and more of that as the population gets older. And I think it's going to be a question of efficiencies. I think, yes, okay, maybe, you know, Joe doesn't have his job anymore, but it may be unfortunate for Joe. However, I mean, there's maybe another, and Bernie, just as you said, there'll be another venue or opportunity for the Joes of the world to kind of step in. Maybe in the service, one of the growing, and it has been for the longest time, areas of growth have to do with dealing with our elderly population. You have to keep that in mind. I mean, yes, we're getting older. Yes, people are retired out of the workforce. We may not have as many youngins who can turn around and, you know, supplement the workforce, but keep in mind that it's not a one-to-one replacement situation. So I think we'll work ourselves out of it. I thank you both for adding some invaluable points. I mean, great discussion. Really, really enjoyed it. Thank you both for taking the time to read a rather long article. And again, your comments, just wonderful. Thank you both.
By the way, Fred, if there are no problems,
together now, there are no opportunities.
There are no opportunities. as a side note, if you have a project or you got a topic you'd like to know more about, send your emails to info@gentryres.com. That's info@gentryres.com.
Brilliant. Thank you, Bernie.
Check out the new course offerings at gentrylearning.com. There you'll find answers to all your real estate investment questions. Divided into easy-to-learn interactive segments, it's the affordable way to gain invaluable insight and knowledge into the world of real estate investing. Start the right way. Visit gentrylearning.com.
Wizards, we are pleased to introduce to you our guest. Philippe Larocque is a CPA and a licensed insolvency trustee. He is a partner at BDO Canada and serves clients across Ottawa, Eastern Ontario, and Western Quebec. With over 15 years of experience in insolvency and restructuring, Philippe specializes in personal debt solutions, including consumer proposals and bankruptcies. He also has extensive expertise in managing complex commercial insolvency files. Welcome to the show, Phil.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm a longtime listener, big fan. Fred, I've known you for almost the full 15 years that I have been in insolvency, and really appreciate the approach you bring and enjoy working together.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure to have you. It really, really is. I'm just tickled pink that you accepted our invitation.
Of course, with these topics, it's hard not to.
No, that's we try to make it entertaining. We try to make it relevant. And you're just going to be one more brick, because this, I'm really looking forward to, you know, our Q&A section for sure. So let's start you off right away. For our listeners unfamiliar with the role, what does a receiver actually do? And why are you often the first person to uncover financial fraud?
So in Canada, a receiver can be acting in one of two ways. Either it's a private appointment as a receiver, so a secured creditor such as a financial institution. I've also seen insurance companies sometimes appoint a receiver, and essentially it's there to go realize on the assets that were given as a guarantee to a loan. When files are maybe a bit more complex, so for example, maybe you have assets in different provincial jurisdictions, you may have a receiver that is appointed by the court. And so you would actually have a court order appointing a receiver to go realize on the assets. The role of a receiver is exactly that, to get the assets and to liquidate them. There's various ways that you can do that. You can either just go through a pure kind of auction liquidation process. Receiver can also sometimes run the business for a period of time in order to realize the maximum amount of value. And that can be tied. There's multiple assets, right? So if you think of a manufacturing facility, there could be real estate underlying that as well. So the role can vary depending on, you know, the stakeholders involved.
So are you working for, you're appointed by the court in most instances,
mm-hmm.
and you are working on behalf of the creditors or the debtor?
We're working on behalf of the creditors.
Okay. All right.
Your ultimate accountability as an officer of the court. So you do report back to the court, but you have a duty or a responsibility towards all the stakeholders involved. So obviously we're trying to maximize realization for the creditors, but oftentimes, you know, the debtor, the owners of the business likely have personal guarantees, could be creditors themselves. And depending on the realization, if they're shareholders as well, obviously shareholders are at the, let's call it the back of the bus, but there are instances where the creditors are paid in full and funds do go to the owners.
That's a happy ending. Bernie?
It sounds like a complex deal, and I suspect some people might want to stack the deal in their favor if they are the ones being dissolved, so to speak. Are there, from a real estate perspective, are there files that normally get kind of fluffed or falsified?
So you can find, I mean, there's always going to be divergent points of view, let's say, right? So if I'm selling a piece of real estate, the owner of the company that is in receivership likely thinks that it's worth a lot more. There is always the value of the property is essentially what someone is willing to pay for it. And when a property is in distress, and Fred and I, we've had conversations about this for a long time, right? The value is much different, sadly. So it's not the same as let's pick on a manufacturing facility, right? If there's a piece of property with a manufacturing facility and there's a manufacturer in there that is working, operating, that property is worth a lot more than a vacant factory its own, right? So likely the scenario here, especially if the business wasn't viable to begin with, so keeping the operations going isn't in the cards, the business will cease to operate. It will go into liquidation mode. And then eventually, once all of the, let's call it manufactured equipment, have been liquidated, then the real estate gets sold at the end.
Yeah, that's very often the case. That's a huge, huge part of our business, dealing with situations like that. And you were right in your opening comment. There's very often a big difference between what the owner feels it's worth and what that property is going to bring on an open market, given the fact that it's a vacant property. I mean, unless you find another manufacturer, and the problem with many of these manufacturing buildings is that they are purpose-built. They're built specifically for the manufacturer of a specific item. And that sometimes doesn't lend itself very, very well to a new one, not without there being a considerable amount of capital spent to retrofit it to a point where it's usable again. So at the end of the day, you know, what a buyer may be prepared to pay for it, it is going to be greatly diminished, particularly if they have to spend millions of dollars making it appropriate for their uses. So great, all good points. So are there any obvious red flags when it comes to if you've been appointed and you're going through various files and all of a sudden you can see or judge that, you know, there's been a third party forgery, you know, something that's just obvious that kind of sticks out that you would kind of be, that you would be looking for when it comes to those situations?
Every file is different. So there's never one tell, but yeah, forgeries, you know, either amounts receivable that aren't actually real. Those are, you know, falsified invoices. So it could even be rent that's due, but isn't actually due. but it's on the books. So really, you know, one of the big things as a receiver is we also, depending on the mandate that we're given by the court, we're likely reviewing the books and records. We're trying to wrap up any outstanding tax filings. And that's where you kind of stumble upon this missing or falsified information, right? And I would tend to say as a receiver, it's usually inconsistencies in the information. So it might be two sets of books as an example, and it's hard to reconcile the two to really figure out what is real and what is not.
So how often in a receivership would you suggest is there evidence of fraudulent activity?
That's hard to say.
And I want to share with our listeners an example that I came across a few weeks ago where a building was taken over by a receiver. Our firm was approached to fulfill the court order, and which we did. The existing tenant or tenants were, for lack of a better word, evicted. This was all done, you know, we don't do this in the middle of the working day to create a great big kerfuffle, but it was done. The building was secure. And then all of a sudden, mysteriously, two or three leases just manifested themselves, third-party leases. Now, when you buy a piece of real estate, as we all know, you need to abide by the terms and conditions contained in any existing tenancy agreements. When I say tenancy agreements, it's not just residential. I'm talking about commercial tenancy agreements, because the owner of the property is deemed to be separate from the tenant. And that's all. It makes perfect sense from a business standpoint. And if you're a tenant, you want that type of protection. But in this particular case, what we discovered was that these leases more than likely didn't exist before the doors were locked. They were predated, but it was pretty obvious that, well, if these leases had existed before, they would have never been locked out. So I'm talking about an instance like that where it's pretty blatant and someone has purposely gone back and changed an historical document to kind of circumvent, you know, the receivership. Did you come across those, like, to me, what are very obvious, you know, frauds?
It's something that exists. It's definitely there. I've run into instances, not necessarily the exact one that you had, but I had, we sold a building once where there were still amounts receivable for charges to tenants. Those tenants were nowhere to be found. Couldn't really ever receive that. I've also seen, you know, invoicing that was, let's say, issued before services were delivered so that they could be counted towards, you know, the aging of receivables. So really, you know, inconsistencies again in that information and what's real and what's not. So yeah, it's, you know, sadly, Fred, I think that the way that I would characterize it is that, and I'm stealing a line from Dave Ramsey in the US, you know, when you get desperate, you do dumb things, right? And yeah, you know, oftentimes owners, you know, are looking to continue their business. They want to try and get out of it. And sometimes, you know, these things do happen.
They do stupid things. I think I'm looking at this from the perspective of, you know, as we've said time and time again now, even during this show, if there are no problems, there are no opportunities. So if someone or a building has fallen into receivership, you know, the whole exercise here is to make a potential buyer aware of what things to look for. So at the end of the day, never take a document that's being supplied by either the bankrupt or the, for lack of a better word, the debtor. They may not be bankrupt at face value. Do your due diligence.
I was going to say, I totally agree. And it comes back to one of the principles that you had at the beginning of the show, right? You got to do your due diligence, right? You got to ask questions. You got to investigate. And even as a receiver, a lot of the times we're selling without any warranties or representations. So we may be presenting information, and that's the problem with fraud. It's hard to detect, right? So there could be, depending on the size of the asset being sold, inconsistencies in information that are being relayed. So really take your time when you're looking through a deal.
Great. Bernie.
Based on what you just said, it almost sounds like, you know, an amateur as opposed to someone that's skilled at the sleight of hand. You know, I mean, I know there are people out there that, you know, That is their business, right? Setting things up and then having it fold and collapse, and but making money out of the deal. Is it more one than the other? Is it more like, geez, I'm just doing something really dumb that I'm trying to, the guy that's drowning and anything will do, right, to stay afloat?
In my experience, that's mostly what I see. It's not necessarily people who are, it's hard to judge intent, but typically, these are not major fraudsters who are perpetuating a Ponzi scheme. There are obviously Ponzi schemes out there. And the majority of the time, based on what I've seen again, you can almost judge the intent because the issue, like the little bit of fraud that did exist, was so small. It was either a clerical error or it was done with certain, presumptions of future facts that never actually materialized. And then it was never corrected, right? So it's hard. Again, you can't really, how do you peg down the intent? But if you read between the lines, I think it's more one than the other.
Would you ever kick it over to the police if you come across something going, this isn't tiny, this is like materially significant?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the Office of the Superintendent does have a relationship with the RCMP. They do refer files over to the RCMP annually. Every year, we do get reports from the superintendent on the number of files that do get investigated and any convictions. I think the other question is it a criminal matter or is it a civil matter, right? And that, I guess, it depends on the fraud being perpetuated and the damages that were incurred.
So in that particular case, does intent actually play a role? Because you may not have realized it, but the intention was never to criminally, create a fraud, but that in fact is what happened. So in that particular case, whose discretion is it? Is it the receiver's discretion, or would it be solely up to the appointed receiver in that case to determine or to forward a complaint?
The receiver can forward a complaint. Anyone involved in an insolvency proceeding can complain. So whether that's the creditor, even the debtor, if they feel that the process hasn't been fair. So and again, if you're complaining to the superintendent of bankruptcy, usually you're looking at misconduct, not necessarily just unfairness, right? So I would tend to say it depends, right? It's really driven on circumstance. And I think the big thing when it comes to referring files, the superintendent has told our association that really it's a matter of priority, right? So they're looking at it from, the resources that would have to go into conducting the investigation. They'll refer, but then the RCMP does its own analysis as well.
How much of a role does AI and, this new wave of editing software play a role in the quality of, these fraudulent transactions or documents? Is it becoming more and more relevant?
So the problem is you don't know what you don't know, right? And to a certain extent, some AI forgeries, very good. Some not so good. It's definitely top of mind. And that can be, when people are providing you evidence of, maybe debts outstanding, you really start questioning, is this a true statement or is this maybe a fabrication? Even if you wanted to go as far as, employment letters, is this a real employment letter or is it a falsified one?
Yeah, and that does constitute a fraud. It's very much, most people think it's somewhat benign, but that's the same as filling out fraudulent information on a mortgage application.
That's the type of fraud that we see the most, I would say, in the insolvency. It's misrepresentation of income or assets in the application process. So the know your client aspect, right? That the bankers, that's the banking terminology that they often use. Like if you're a mortgage broker, that's a very important step.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point that it comes up, but you're absolutely 100% correct on that basis. That's been my experience anyways. You need to, very often you wonder, how did this individual ever get into trouble? How did this ever happen? Because from all appearances, everything seems, above board. Everything seemed very copacetic, but under closer review, you very quickly realize, nah, this doesn't hold any water. Bernie.
There's two different types of property. You have residential versus commercial. Does it show itself differently? Like, is it, like, for example, for residential, getting a mortgage and you're doing a misrepresentation on earnings versus something in the commercial space? What shows up in the commercial space that's different?
So just based on my experience, the commercial space, there's a lot more information that, you know, is used to derive value. So rent rolls, one of the important ones, right? So, you know, what are the transact or the nature of the agreements, right, with the tenants, length of time, amount of rent, et cetera. Those are, it takes much more time to review that when you're conducting a commercial deal. The residential deal, typically, you know, very easy to get an appraisal done on a property. And it's easy also to get more than one done, typically. There's a lot of information available online if you look around. Commercial properties, you know, the value of the commercial property, much more, I would say, in my experience, it's in the eyes of the beholder, right? It really, how do they value the value of the future revenues?
Yep, for sure. So I would imagine that most residential appointments, or rather appointments that involve residential real estate, where there's been any degree of fraud, it's usually in the original application, something, misstatement of assets, misrepresenting income, employment, those type things. When it comes to commercial, it can be all that plus more. Financial statements, contracts, accounts payable, receivable, all those things. And that's why I find that a lot of banks have really pulled back on what they'll advance in terms of a credit facility when it comes to accounts receivable. You know, it used to be part of the financial package. You know, your bank, you could count on your bank to support you to a certain percentage of what your receivables were, just to ensure adequate cash flow. So sure. So let's change gears a bit here. So you've been appointed a receiver. What's your first 48 hours like?
Take possession and secure the property. So take possession, physically walk in, let everyone know you're here, secure the premise, make sure that, you know, there's no damage that can be done while you're in possession. Obviously, you have to insure that property as well. And then make sure that you have, you know, a contingency plan in place. So in other words, if there's a fire that night, who's responding, right? So typically, you know, as a receiver, we're working as a team. So we typically would have some of our colleagues involved as well. So who's going to respond to what and when, and getting to know the lay of the land. So the other thing too would be, you know, ensuring that you have a good understanding of the rent that you're going to be receiving, over the course of the month, and knowing what the expenses are going to be. So you can plan out the cash flow, as a consequence of that. There's likely a cash flow shortfall. So typically the secured lender has to be made aware real quick. So they're going to be able to fund it throughout the sales process. And then just beyond the 48 hours, let's say a week or two in, is really putting together that sales process. How are you going to sell this, and who are you going to be using?
And who are you going to call when all else fails?
Call Fred.
Bertie.
Just in that first 48 hours, do you post notices? Like, how do you, I get the lender is advised, right? Because the whole process has been initiated by them. But let's say the business is viable. There might be something else that's caused this to trigger, or it might be other complications, but the business itself can function if it's free of other concerns. How do you alert everybody that this is transition, that, you know, I'm going to pay my rent to Phil, and not Phil directly, of course, but to, you know, to your company? How does that process unfold?
So typically there is a notice that goes out the door. That's one of the first things. And then if you're running the business, so the receiver in any receivership has a duty to send out a notice that the receivership is in place, so that the, you know, the various creditors and stakeholders understand. The debtor is not always present in the process, especially in a court appointment. They may or may not oppose that appointment. So they'll need to be notified as well. And then it's usually one-on-one, you know, conversations with the stakeholders in place. So if you're trying to run a business and you have vital suppliers, need to, you know, make sure that we have an understanding of how supplies are going to be delivered, what the payment terms are going to be moving forward, and negotiate the negotiation of all of that.
Does it release any obligations either from the tenants or the suppliers? Like, the supplier might be going, you know what, this is risk. I'm risk adverse. Nice knowing you. Ciao.
Yep, that's completely within their rights. They have no they do not need to supply going forward. A lot of the times the terms negotiated are cash on delivery of any new supplies going forward. Things like hydro, you know, utilities have to be switched over to the receiver's name as well. So there's it can be a very busy 48 hours to 2 weeks.
Have you ever come across a file, Phil, that's a real quagmire where there's multiple parties simultaneously producing fraudulent documents and arguing with each other? And how do you deal with that? I mean, do you add more weight from one to the other, or do you just like, well, what happens when you're given two opposing statements, like rent rolls, for instance? The landlord or the property owner is giving you one rent roll, but when you go to the tenant's telling you another story. What happens when there's inconsistencies in the bank statements? You know, you come across one bank statement that says one thing, and then I guess this would lend itself very well to the example that you gave earlier about being a duo set of books. You know, and appraisals are another one. I've seen appraisals where the actual appraisal document has been manipulated, where the original said this, and then the lender was provided with one that said that. Like, what do you do in a situation like that? How do you work yourself through it? Or is this kind of like a self-fulfilling, you don't pay any attention, or you just attempt to go out and either recreate the documents or go to your own third-party suppliers to determine what's real and what isn't?
So it's definitely a challenge. We basically go on a fact-finding mission, right? So if you're looking at agreements, a lot of the times it's we do have an underlying agreement that is in writing, but there were also a lot of handshake agreements, and so it's hard to quantify those. So we look for documentation to that effect. And there's various ways of doing that, right? So you may have a lease agreement that states, you know, one price, but the price being paid for the last 2 years is very different, right? So you can kind of establish that there's some inconsistencies within the information. That's not necessarily a fraud, but those are the types of things that we walk into and have to figure out, right? When it comes to appraisals, you know, if you're really doubting an appraisal, best to get your own independent appraisal. And typically, like, you know, appraisers are professionals. They have opinions and they look at various data points. So every appraisal doesn't necessarily come in with the same value. So a lot of times if we're looking to sell a piece of property and we want to establish what a range could be, we'll get three appraisals and take an average of the three. So there is a bit of it does take time to get to the bottom of the issues. The one thing though that I have seen in my experience is that the party that's perpetuating the fraud, typically, when a court order receivership steps into place, they disappear real quick.
Oh, really?
So it's difficult to, you know, get both sides of the story, right? And so if I'm working with a creditor who is saying, well, this is how much is owed, I don't have the other side of the story. So that can be difficult. We can look at through correspondence that's maybe left in the file. Some people, sometimes you might have multiple owners and one of the two or three are willing to work with the receiver to try and maximize the recovery. So there's all kinds of different scenarios. It's not that, like, not one file is ever really the same. And it's also really difficult because, you know, naturally you hold some level of skepticism, right? When someone is telling you something. So it's really, you want to trust, you try to trust, but you got to verify.
Yeah. Trust, but verify. Trust but verify. Yeah, truer words were never spoken. Bernie.
Wow. Nothing at face value, which is important. So who typically is the behind these frauds? A true fraud as opposed to, you know, you misentered an entry, right? You're depositing checks and you just goofed up on the data entry at the machine, right? Versus someone who's going, I'm going to have to do this. Who's typically behind it? Is it the drowning person, drowning man, or is it a combination of things?
So it can be a combination of things. We've even seen cases where the owner is unaware of a fraud being perpetuated by the person who runs the finances for the company. So it's not necessarily always one source. I would even go as far as saying it's not even, like, there's not a, can't point to one persona, if that makes sense. Like, it can literally be anyone, right? And I come back to that same, you know, when you're desperate, you do dumb things. Typically, there's a driving element behind the person who's perpetuating that fraud.
So without naming names, what's the most audacious case of document fraud you've ever encountered?
So I was very, very fortunate in my career. I was invited to the U.S. by the FDIC, who was appointed receiver over a small community bank in the south end of Chicago. And that was a financial fraud that was being committed. So just to give you a, you know, roughly kind of a size of what was going on, the bank had deposits in the realm of about $120 million. And when the FDIC was appointed receiver, they were only able to quantify about $60 million worth of true mortgages that were outstanding. So there was a gap
of $60 million.
$60 million. And in that particular circumstance, the FBI was also involved. And there is, if you look it up, there are news articles out there. So obviously the president of the bank was deeply involved. That gentleman committed suicide approximately a week before the receivership started. And most of the staff who were also involved in the financial operation of that bank were also somewhat in the know. And there were actually charges pressed on the accounting company that was doing the audit as well. So that was by far the biggest fraud I've ever seen. I was not directly involved. I was there as an observer, and I was very thankful to be part of that process. It was very interesting. I was very impressed at how the FDIC works with its government stakeholder groups. So the Office of the Comptroller was there. The FBI was there. It was impressive.
Wow. So how was that fraud discovered?
It was discovered. So in the U.S., the Office of the Comptroller is basically...
You need to have a certain amount of deposits to cover. Yes. Okay.
And so they were doing their regulatory, you know, reviews. Same thing. The FDIC was in doing some regulatory reviews, and that's where they spotted that, you know, they were having cash flow issues. And essentially there were basically two sets of books. There were a lot of inconsistencies, and they weren't able to trace, you know, the deposits and the mortgages being like the mortgage payments.
Wow. $60 million.
And that was at the time of the failure of that bank. So when the FDIC steps in, the bank ceases to operate, and then it gets liquidated. That was the amount that was being questioned at the time. I haven't actually followed up on it. This is something that probably happened in the, let's call it 2017, 2018 era. And so it would be interesting. I'm sure it's in the news. They're very transparent in their reporting. It's all probably on the FDIC's website.
So in that case, was the president of the bank, what, just misappropriating funds, basically lending money out to friends? You had no idea, no concept at that point in time.
No, that would have, and I don't know if they'll ever get to the root of it. That's part of the problem with the fraud is that it's often hard to get all the facts.
If you're finding that someone is going misrepresentation on purpose with intent, in other words, you know, it's a criminal, it's not a typo. Do you find that it's more one-off, or is it a more an organized effort, part of a larger body of people? Do you see that coming on the rise, or do you, because as the economy gets tighter, right, money becomes a little more, people become hungrier for money?
That's a good question. I don't know if you can, I mean, it's difficult to answer because you never really know, right? Again, the problem with fraud is that it's so hard to uncover, and then It comes back to the you don't know what you don't know, right? So you may have come to your own conclusions, but do you really know the true story, right? Are there more parties involved that you may not be aware of? Are there criminal organizations involved that you might not be aware of, right? There could be a front person who takes the fall, but there's more people behind. You know, you could always question, especially in an organization, right? You know, how much collusion, right? Is the board of directors involved? Are they aware? Like there's just, or it could be one member, like you never know. So it's interesting. It takes a lot of resources to do that kind of digging and a lot of expertise, right? So as a receiver, you're usually the person who kind of stumbles upon these inconsistencies, but you're not necessarily, you know, your role is to liquidate. You're not there as a
investigator,
right? So if you really do, you know, find that there's too many inconsistencies that you can't wrap your head around, that's a good time to either look to a forensic accountant, to look to authorities who can help with that investigation.
Mm, what an interesting vocation. Like you said, I can understand why it's so attractive to you, because it's every file is different.
There's never a dull day.
Yeah, I find the same thing in the recovery portion of our business. Very much the same. Every file is different. Every different personalities, different properties, every file is different. So where do you see real estate document fraud? I mean, how are you going to police it? You know, considering the advancements in AI over the next several years, I mean, what are we going to be doing? I mean, like, I just, you know, you've got one side of the equation, which is an almost made for the creation of fraudulent documents. But how, like, how are we going to be able to police that? How are we going to be able to recognize it in the future? Or is it a crapshoot?
Well, I guess you hope that the AI detection tools keep up with the pace of AI development. That's definitely difficult. I mean, in real estate, again, based on my experience, one of the stopgaps is the real estate lawyers too that are involved, right? They have a duty to, they have access to the land registry, record these transactions. So they wear a lot of responsibility, right? So I'm sure that when it comes to, you know, how to spot and detect and follow up on potential fraudulent activity, they're much better placed to talk about that than I am. But yeah, it's always, the fear is you don't know what you don't know, right? And as AI develops, you know, even voice, like the you know,
recognition
of, yeah, voice recognition, like it's really sophisticated today, right? You can be fooled very easily. So I think it comes back to, you know, the high pressure sales tactics, right? When something has to be done immediately, right? There's a huge time pressure when you don't understand or know the parties involved, right? Those are really the big red flags.
Yeah. What a wonderful, like, Rob spoke directly to that, didn't he, Bernie? Directly to that. This has just flowed beautifully. Thank you so much for that point. Do you want to take us, Bernie?
FOMO shouldn't be part of the solution map, you know, if you're missing out, right? Piece of advice, you know, and I realize, you know, if the receiver is in play, it might be the advice for the receiver, but for the person that is running a business, I guess, what would be the advice to the business person to address an issue? And let's say maybe they're running, their business is not viable. What is the smart move? Because at the end of the day, if you're buying the business and you're doing your due diligence, it'll surface, right? You know, when you have a team in there. So I guess the advice to the listeners, if you're running a business and it's grounding, you know, you're running aground, what do you recommend? You know, what's the smart move?
So I have two pieces of advice. Rely on professionals, your accountant, your lawyer.
Right.
Rely on them, right? That's a really important one. And that can go beyond that too, right? So Fred, you and I have had a lot of discussions, right? Rely on the real estate agent too, who's telling you the property's not worth what you think it is, right? Listen to the professionals. They know what they're doing. I think that's really important. The other thing that's really important is, and it's tied in with honesty is the best policy, right? Have an open and frank relationship with your bank. They see your bank balance. They know what you owe. It's very hard to hide something from your bank. And the more communication that happens, I think a lot of the times people don't understand how flexible some bankers are. But when you don't communicate, they become very inflexible. So in my experience, when we get appointed receiver, a lot of the times that relationship is extremely ice cold, and a lot of problems can be avoided if
it existed at all.
Yeah, if it existed at all.
No, because it's not the same. And I was commenting, or I had this discussion last week, you know, we were talking about, you know, bank relationships, and it used to be, when, you know, you started a banking relationship, you dealt with the same bank, and chances are that you stuck it out with the same bank manager, and it was, you built a relationship. Now, that's not the case anymore. That's not the case. I mean, it is very, very, I don't know about the two of you, but I know all sorts of circumstances where it's difficult to even get a hold of somebody on the phone. You know, and every time you do, you're dealing with a different person. And God forbid you need to do something like change a bank card. But anyways, we don't need to go there.
No, friend, that's a great point, right? And it's really, really hard to form a relationship when you're facing financial trouble, right? You need to have already had a relationship with your account manager.
Yes, yes, good point.
And I think, you know, you really have to look at professionals and your bank as business partners, right? So if you're growing a business, the credit facilities you have today probably aren't the credit facilities you needed 5 years from now. And if they don't change, that can cause a lot of hardship too, right? We've seen a lot of public bankruptcies, public receiverships where, you know, it is a viable business, but the credit facilities weren't right. They weren't fulfilling the needs of the business. The business wasn't able to succeed as a result of that. So
all that to say, again, if there are no problems,
there are no opportunities.
There we go. Phil, thank you so very much. This has been so informative, and it's definitely, I'm sure, it's given everybody food for thought.
I've got one question. Sorry, Phil. And this, we've talked about the bank, right? The lender. How does CRA figure in this? Have you ever had a CRA moment where they go, they owe us a boatload of cash. Let's go for it.
So CRA will never appoint a receiver. CRA, depending on the nature of the debt, so if it's income tax related, if it's HST, GST, like a consumption tax related, or if it's source deduction, they'll take different stances. They have different priorities, let's call it, in the receivership. But they typically don't take an active, I'm in charge and I'm going to drive this process forward. So it's usually a secured creditor who may have to deal with a super priority claim in front of them.
So we're not going to quite let you off the hook yet. We have this is all part of Know Our Guest. You know, we talked about Know Your Customer. Now we're going to let our listeners know a little more about you. So we got some rapid fire Q&As, not meant to be big elaborate answers, just really fast. Bernie, you want to start us off right now?
Oh, Fred, absolutely. So, Phil, what book are you reading right now?
So I am reading a book called Leadership is Language. It's by David Marquette. He's a former U.S. Navy captain. Talks about leadership in the military, but also transitioned out of the military and worked in various high-tech areas. And so really interesting read. Talks about how language is so important.
Now, is that because of interest in military history, or is it more of a lesson in leadership for you?
So definitely lesson in leadership. And this was actually a book from my managing partner. So really? I owe it to her. We all got a copy, and it's actually turned out to be a great read. It really is.
Fantastic. And the name of that book again for our listeners?
Leadership is Language by David Marquette.
Thank you for that. So do you have a favorite book?
I do not have a favorite book, but I do have a favorite way of, I'm going to call it in air quotes, reading. I listen to Audible in the car and I absolutely love it.
Really? Great. That's good. Bernie.
So now that we've done book, how about meal? Do you have a favorite meal?
I do. I could eat pizza for breakfast, lunch, and supper all day, every day for the rest of my life.
Spicy? Spicy one?
Anything, anything. I'm even going to go as far as saying I would even eat Hawaiian pizza.
Oh, really?
I know that's controversial.
Oh, wow. Yeah, good one.
Okay, this question may have already been answered. What goes well with pizza? What's your favorite alcoholic beverage?
So it's got to be beer. And I really have two types of beer that I love. I love a deep, heavy IPA. Okay. And I also love a crisp pilsner on a hot day.
Wow, good for you.
So you've got a book, you got a pizza, and you got a pint. What's your perfect day then?
So my perfect day. So I have a Sea-Doo. I love getting out on the water. And I have a little lawn chair that folds up and goes into the trunk, the nose trunk. And so going out on the Ottawa River, beaching it on a sandbar and just relaxing in quiet tranquility. It's in the sun. It's perfect.
Wow. Sounds really nice. What's your favorite place to visit in the world?
Caribbean. I love the clear water, sandy beaches, hot weather.
Any particular island?
No, actually. There's probably more that I haven't visited, but I did have a trip way back in the time machine to Jamaica, and that is a beautiful island with really hospitable people.
Yeah, being there. Bernie?
Favorite ice cream? Because, you know, if you're going to all these warm places now, maybe not with the pizza, maybe not the ice cream pizza pint, but do you have a favorite ice cream?
I do. And it's vanilla.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely.
Any particular brand?
It's got to be vanilla bean. The vanilla with the little black specks. That's where it's at right there.
That's what you like, for sure. That's wonderful. One last task for you. I would really appreciate it if you could explain to our listeners what is wire fraud.
So I actually had to look this one up because I thought wire fraud was if you were conducting fraudulent wire activities, like wire transfers. But it turns out the wire fraud is actually broader than that. And it's anything that is done fraudulently through electronic communications. So phishing, scams would qualify as wire fraud, which I found to be really interesting. There's also in the definition, it has to be international, apparently.
Oh, really? Now that's something I didn't know. Well.
So are you telling me then if you get a receivership of a business and it turns out to be a call center that's scamming people,
I guess
you're it? Then I think then you're in the organized level of the criminal activity group at that point.
Philip, thank you once again for being our guest today. I'm sure there'll be all sorts of questions for you. What's the best way for someone to get a hold of you?
Yeah, so Fred, I would love to be a recurring guest, so that would be great. Best way to get a hold of me, you can look me up on social media, LinkedIn. We have BDOS offices across the country, so if anyone is ever in need of information with regards to insolvency proceedings, we have offices everywhere. And you can get a hold of me through our website, where you can find all my information.
Brilliant. Anything you care to add, Bernie?
Well, this enlightening, you know, I understand the role of a receiver, you know, but, you know, here's the nuanced levels. But to add to the overall picture, you know, if you want to keep up with what Fred's got on the go, he's got a newsletter called Property Wise Newsletter, and you'll find the latest investment opportunities, links to favorite podcasts and Fred's Property Wizard podcast, all with a little bit of education thrown in, and the cost, the time it takes to sign up. And you know what? If there are no problems,
there are no opportunities.
Plus, if you have a project or a topic you'd like to know more about, send your emails to info@gentryres.com. That's info@gentryres.com.
Thank you, wizards. Till the next episode.
Thanks for listening to Fred and Bernie on another edition of The Property Wizard, brought to you by Creative Insight, helping you connect, and Gentry Learning, real estate professionals and educators. Got a question? Ready to invest? Email info@gentryres.com. And if you'd like to find out more about the courses offered through Gentry Learning, visit gentrylearning.com. Remember to like and leave us a comment and subscribe to the show so you never miss an episode of The Property Wizard.